Hello, everybody. This is Jeff Salzman, and welcome to the Integral Living Room Community Call. It's good to feel your presence all over the world, and thank you for joining us tonight as we take another look at the topic of integral activism and how we can help heal the world and help move things along in a way that is that eases suffering. And we're, of course, preparing for the Integral Living Room, which is coming up in a month or so. It's it's November 9th through 12th. And it's at Boulder, Colorado, of course. And if you are interested in attending and are considering attending, we wanted to announce that we have dropped the price by $100. So you can go to the website and register and use the word SHOUT, S-H-O-U-T, as the code for getting a discount if you are interested in signing up.
Just a quick thing. It's all caps. S-H-O-U-T in all caps.
So welcome, Di. You're Diane Musso Hamilton here with us.
Hi, everybody. I'm really happy to be on the call. I'm in Salt Lake City, beautiful fall day today, and looking forward to our conversation.
Great. And Terry, welcome to you, Terry Patton.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Di. Hi, everybody. I'm delighted to be here, too, from beautiful Marin County, California.
Right on. Terry has just written a new book that is it out yet, Terry, or you holding it in your hand?
No, Jeff. It won't be out till February or March. It's just been written.
Oh, okay. Not so far away, though, but no. It's a book right on the topic of what we're doing in the living room, which is A New Republic of the Heart, and it's the first book on integral activism. And, you know, we're all really excited to have it and to hear from you tonight, Terry. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what brought you to the topic and what you see happening as we try to engage our hearts with this this world that we're in?
Sure. Yeah, thanks. I'll offer a little, I don't know, maybe I'll talk for 15 minutes or so and offer a little bit of an introduction to how I see integral activism, having taken a pretty deep dive into the topic. You know, I see social responsibility as a dimension of practice. Our original formulation of integral life practice identified the body, the mind, spirit and shadow as the four core modules, but they're my body, my mind, my spirit, my shadow. And there are other modules that are relational. There are intimate relationships. There's our work. And then there's our relationship to the public sphere. And in this time, where in so many ways, our society, our politics, our culture, and especially our planetary ecology are so profoundly threatened, this cultural dimension of practice is more important than it's ever been. But the images that we have of activism, marching in the streets, protesting, maybe getting involved in a party politics and trying to elect a particular candidate, are only really expressing a few of the dimensions of what a truly integral activism can be. And there are many, many forms of activism that we're already doing that we don't always attach that word to. I use a simple taxonomy in the book at one point of identifying that there's in-the-system activism. And that's where we're voting, we're contributing money to a candidate, we may be volunteering our time, getting involved in a party, in an actual political party. And that's actually a pretty important and profound area of activism that many of us have let go of that we're realizing we have to get back involved with. We've ceded that in the system activism to people who are less developed, as we see right now, given the particularly the national politics in the United States. And so I think anybody who didn't vote in the last presidential election has to feel a pang of, gee, did I blow it? Clearly, the people who voted, you know, the big thing that determined the outcome of this last election was the diminished participation of people who would have voted for Hillary Clinton. So this sense that our franchise, our voting responsibility is an essential aspect of our citizenship does need to be restored. There's a dignity and a value to working within the system. It's also true, though, that an integral activist sometimes is going to engage in against-the-system activism. You know, all those people who flooded to the airports after that first travel ban, they helped real human beings whose lives and circumstances were being thrown into jeopardy. Particularly the attorneys who helped out really made a difference. They made a huge difference in one way that I can see and identify. I'd bet you that if they had not done their mission of mercy, we would have had far more people in this country and around the world radicalized by the hostility of the travel ban itself. But seeing that this country was full of people who cared about those people made a difference, I think a tangible difference. And there are other key ways that marching and protesting and defying authority, civil disobedience, you know, have heralded all kinds of important social changes. But integralists often prefer and are able to be creative by going around the system. Many, many, many of the things that we do, the Integral Living Room itself, the Daily Evolver, Two Arrows Zen, Bay Area Integral, all of our personal initiatives are educational, they uplift individuals and communities. There are countless activities that we're engaging that don't necessarily work directly in any political system, even an informal political system. We go around the system very often coloring outside the lines. There's the usual division of society into the public sector, the private sector, and the nonprofit sector. But those rigid divisions between public, private, and nonprofit are being violated again and again and again now, people coloring outside the lines and creating what's often called the fourth sector. And that's the social entrepreneurship, the public-private partnerships, the venture philanthropy, the impact investing, where the B Corps, all kinds of new projects. And that's a lot of what probably a lot of the people on this call right now and many of our friends are engaging. We're going around the system to make a difference. But there isn't yet as full and as clear an understanding of our ways of engaging as I think are coming into being. I think that the Trump election has actually served as almost a vaccination. The degree of I think we have been offended on so many levels, so deeply, and we're recognizing the threats to our well-being at this very same time that we are also seeing the severity of our environmental crisis, the severity of these recent hurricanes, the intensity and widespread nature of the wildfires that have ravaged the West, What have we had? At one point in 2016, there were 16 consecutive months that were the hottest month on record in the history of record keeping. We have had the hottest year on record for, I think, 3 straight years. So the fact that we're in a tremendously significant moment is the context for our activism. The more we examine what's going on, the more impressed we are with these wondrous, amazing, transformational, positive changes, some of them in taking the form of new technologies. And we're mostly especially inspired by the social and cultural and consciousness breakthroughs that we're participating in, which really do hold the promise to transform society. Ken Wilber often points out that when as many as 10% of the members of a population reach a new and higher structure stage of consciousness, there comes an opportunity for radical changes in which the rules of the public sphere can be entirely rewritten. But all those wonderful changes are taking place right at the same time that things are coming unglued on so many levels. Any intelligent observer of what's happening in the news, whether it's the mass shooting that has shocked us all in recent days or the severity of the recent hurricanes or whatever, can see that we are facing civilizational level threats. And so it's commonly framed that there's a race between consciousness and catastrophe. But what's clearly necessary if we are to be a part of the wholesome solutions we want to see in our world is a combination of what's traditionally called the inner work and the outer work. It's a holistic engagement in which that higher consciousness is served, but not as if it were a separate matter from our social activism. In a way, every single one of us is waking up to the fact that there is really no center from which social change can be worked that is locatable and specific. Yes, the president has a lot of power. Yes, Congress people have a lot of power. Yes, wealthy billionaires have special roles. So do celebrities with huge followings. But each one of us has a role, too. There's a decentralized locus of control in society as a whole. And therefore, if there is to be a change adequate to address the perilous nature of this tipping point in which amazingly positive changes are brewing and amazingly negative changes, there's disruption, there is the potential for things to come apart at the seams. We're all shocked by that, often into fear. We can sense that when we're afraid, our wisdom is occluded. We know that a kind of faith and trust and optimism are the source of our sanity and strength. And yet, if we simply opt for optimism and confidence and trust without actually dealing with the tangible realities that do point to real peril, we're engaging a spiritual bypass. And so this crisis is an initiation, I think, in all of our lives. It's a cultural initiation. We've all been presented with a great, impossible riddle, an unanswerable question. And it can function something like a koan, a Zen riddle, an impossible question like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Or show me your original face, the one you had before your parents were born. You know, those questions don't have simple answers. We're being, all of us together, faced with questions for which we don't yet have adequate answers. But resting in those questions steadily and together is, in a way, obliged upon us. If we care, and particularly the ecological predicament faces us with moral, what could be more morally important than the kind of world our grandchildren and great-grandchildren are going to be inheriting? What could be more morally significant than the preservation of species and habitats and the beauty of this amazing world we live in? Clearly, it matters tremendously. There could be nothing with more moral force. And yet, the usual way we look at a threat to what we care is with a kind of contraction, urgency. We want to rush in and do something. The heroes, that we've been hearing about the last few days who helped people to safety from this hail of gunfire could see what needed to be done and act positively and directly and immediately, bravely, courageously, and do what clearly needed to be done. Things in this larger crisis are reflect a tangle of karmas that are far less clear-cut. What it is to come forward with real heroism as an activist is much more complex and not so obvious. We have to see with deep time eyes. We have to understand complex, non-obvious, paradoxical dynamics. To act effectively in this circumstance requires a truly integral consciousness, a really awakened consciousness that recognizes both the wholeness and the ways in which wholeness is injured and broken apart. It requires a kind of freedom from a gripped, anxious relationship to this crisis, and at the same time, deep care and commitment, you know, to one another and to the common life. I think that what is upon us is going to draw us more and more into a whole new species of important conversations. It's got to do with us recognizing that we really are in a lifeboat together, and that some of the folks in that lifeboat are crazy, and they're armed, and they're hurting others. And there are legacies of trauma and abuse and cruelty and ignorance. There are patterns of worldviews that people are bound by. The kinds of opportunities to create change are sometimes extremely paradoxical and elusive, and yet tremendous change can happen relatively quickly. One of the things that's obvious to me anytime I get down with anybody that I've been able to talk with, I discover a tremendous reservoir of latent heroism and nobility in every human heart. So the crisis conditions that are already beginning to be coming upon us, I think, are a goad to an integration that is, you know, yet to be fully felt. And I see that as reflecting the total intelligence of the human being. One of the ways to think of our intelligence is to relate it to the three primary centers in the human body, the head, the heart, and the hara, or the gut. We have a cluster of neurons. There's even a field, I think it's called neurogastroenterology, the brain in the gut. There's another field, neurocardiology, the brain in the heart. And there are different qualities of intelligence and will that are activated, that gut-level street smarts intelligence that's different from our mental intelligence. And the intelligence that's centered at our heart is uniquely in touch with the gut and the brain. I think that we can talk about a different kind of intelligence. That's the kind of work I did when I was with HeartMath in the 90s, was to identify and help people connect with their heart intelligence. But at this point, I'm not so much interested in moving from the head to the heart. I'm interested in every last bit of mental intelligence and every last bit of gut-level intelligence, all of it integrated at the heart. And that level of intelligence is clearly going to have to come to a new level. We're going to have to come to a point where, at least with some people, we're having conversations that really are guided by and evoking our highest heart-level intelligence. And that's going to have to find its way into collective actions. So one of the things that has me especially excited about what we're going to be doing at the Living Room in just a little while is that we're going to be engaging in a couple of different kinds of actual actions that we can do as a group and enjoy as a group. And the kinds of conversations that we can activate here are prototypes for a whole body of conversations that are being called into being. I think that in the Democratic Party, in the left as a whole, and in the creative art, you know, among artists and intellectuals, there are a whole species of conversations that are beginning to come into being, and people are realizing that love has to become effective in the public sphere. And how we can do that and how we can bring our highest intelligence and wisdom to it is the koan we're going to have to be answering. In the book, I get into this in a whole lot more detail, but I think for the purpose of this call, that's a nice introduction to some of the guiding, orienting generalizations that I've brought to this topic of integral activism. So, I don't know. What do you think of that, Jeff and Di? You have any comments or thoughts?
Di, you want to go? Di, you muted?
I am muted. Sorry about that, you guys. I turned my mic off for a moment. Yeah, I was just kind of receiving what you were talking about, kind of, and feeling the passion and also the encouragement to, you know, to make our relationship within the social domain, and particularly in this case within the public sphere, that I feel highly encouraged to be willing to explore how to do that. You know, this idea that we can operate within the system or against it, or we can operate around it, or you know, kind of maybe even cross the boundaries a little bit, and that a lot of our work is educational or it's transformational, or for some of us it's spiritual work, but that it's still, because of the nature of the changes that we're all facing together, that, you know, this idea that, you know, it's a race between consciousness and catastrophe, it may be that, you know, actually the catastrophe is what's needed for us to actually come from another level of consciousness. So we might be being pressed into ways of being together that we haven't before. So I feel mostly just like really encouraged by what you have to say. I think for those of us who've been engaged in spiritual practice or integral practice, that, you know, we understand that, you know, continuing to engage is what's happening. But I will say this, Terry, and maybe ask for a response from you. I think sometimes that what's challenging for me, we talked about it on the last community call, is sometimes, as we've talked about the complexity of the issues, also the scale of them. You know, humanity's never faced anything on this scale before. And then also how often the divisiveness around an issue can be so frustrating, you know, listening to Fox News's take and then MSNBC and just not able to locate any kind of middle ground and not really even having figures who seem to be known for that. So, you know, that just those, you know, I'm one of these people that I do tend to have an experience sometimes of overwhelm and not being quite sure how to engage. You know, in terms of like climate, I'm not always sure, you know, I can give money here or there. I can sign a petition here or there. But sometimes I want to do something more powerful and more effective, and I'm not really quite sure what that is. So I just want to appreciate being given the big picture and then also just the encouragement that I felt in what you had to say.
Mm. Yeah. Well, thanks, Di. You know, this question of polarization and how profoundly that has us stuck in the United States right now, is a crucial thing that most of the real serious activists among the international integral community are functioning, at least relative to the United States, as transpartisans, transpartisan activists. The building of conversations that cross the boundaries that divide everybody and the contacting of the genuine intelligence and care that motivate people on, you know, across the political spectrum is a core dimension. And you know, Ken believes that the transpartisan movement needs upward development, that true transpartisanship is going to be robust when there are people who have general sympathies on the left or the right who are waking up to higher levels of, and states, both structures and states of consciousness. But the things that we can do as transpartisans are only part of the picture. I think that relative to climate, we won't be able to see the levels of behavior change that are necessary until one of two things create openings, windows of opportunity for much more fundamental systems redesign. One of those is, you know, if this series of hurricane disasters intensifies again next year or the year after that, such that the financial impacts of it cause people to rethink, if we have to abandon a major city, particularly in the first world, that's going to create a political will of a different kind. And the other is technological breakthroughs that really create an opportunity to make fossil fuels non-competitive. That's radical. Mm-hmm. That would make a huge change.
Mm-hmm.
But the work that we need to do to re-knit the fabric of our society such that we don't devolve into a civil war is a necessity that's additional and we can't say it's entirely separate, but it can't be avoided. It's crucial in its own right, whatever is happening with our efforts on climate. And, unfortunately, we're already seeing horrible disruptions of the health of our ecology, and we're seeing terrible suffering. A big theme of mature activism is a deeply, not just compassionate, what is it, a wise and connected and compassionate and passionate relationship to loss and suffering and grief and one another. This re-knitting of our bonds of care is a piece of our work. So I don't think I have an answer to those questions that make the questions go away or that answer them fully.
No,
but I think those observations help us stay with the questions maybe and go even deeper with them. That's what I think is possible.
Yeah. Thank you. I'll just make one small comment and then hand it over to Jeff. But just watching in the States what happened around healthcare and thinking that when the Republicans failed to pass it the last time that was going to put a little rocket fuel under some bipartisanship, particularly when John McCain voted no, I thought that we might, see the parties come together on something. And then the GOP seemed to regroup and just go at it again. So that was really interesting to me, just in terms of this issue around, polarities and the difficulty of finding kind of middle ground. So but that's another conversation. I mean, we can talk more about that in just a minute. So, Jeff, do you have a response that you wanted to offer?
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just mulling it all over, and I feel like I've learned something and even got some more clarity myself from what both of you were just saying, and I'll share it as best I can. Terry, you were talking about just the legacies of trauma and abuse that are part of just the karma of being human. And that is just so true. And it feels like that at least what I'm called to is healing that, as best I can, healing that, burning that karma, if you will. And I think that where we are as a species right now, and I'm talking the leading edge, the basically postmodern into integral, is the legacy of that manifests itself in humanity's self-hatred. And this idea that humans are a cancer on the planet, and we have it's basically a retelling of the apocalypse story, that we have somehow fallen, that we have disobeyed the laws of the universe, and that we must be punished. And I'm just so repulsed by that story. And what I want to offer into the pot here is the idea that there actually is something true about this theory that when we move from first to second tier, we move from a fear operating system, you know, the deficiency needs, to a being, a creative, a loving operating system that actually sees human beings in with loving eyes and sees that what we're doing is not some big mistake, but the kind of mistakes that 9-year-olds make that 12-year-olds don't, that 16-year-olds don't. It's learning and growing and failing our way forward. And that changes it just sort of changes everything for me in terms of not necessarily activism, because I think the activism is what it is. I mean, you get out there and do what you do, but the feeling tone behind it. And I think that's important. That's really what I feel like you're helping me understand that's what I'm called to do. And I can apply it to anything. It's like with climate change, I just noticed that GM promised they just revealed their plans to basically replace all of their gasoline models by electric models by I don't know what year it is, and just the technology.
It's in the next decade. It's not decades ahead. It's in the next.
No,
decade.
It was quite.
2024 comes to mind. Yeah,
yeah,
soonish.
Yeah, so that kind of thing, and that I just want to make sure that those things are on the table, because I think they're really important. Even this, you know, it's probably too soon to bring this up, but in terms of gun violence, it's less than it was 20 years ago by about 50% of what it was, even with these big high-profile, you know, outrageous, you know, acts like Vegas with its sort of special evilness of this guy who went methodically about this project that he had. I mean, that one drops my jaw. But even so, to keep the context that we are actually becoming more and more peaceful as a species, certainly in the modern and postmodern world, at a rapid pace, with blips, you know, it's a sort of pendulum, but the clock is moving, you know, the whole clock moves. So anyway, I just want to put that on the table. I'm not exactly sure where it all fits, but it helps me understand my particular mission in this, you know, this thing that I'm doing, which is helping people to move into integral consciousness as I do it myself.
Well, you know, Jeff, as you read the book, you'll see that I put forward, you know, the two fundamental narratives historically have been called the Malthusian and the Cornucopian, the optimistic narrative that culminates in evolutionary progression and, you know, higher and higher levels and structures and greater dignities and disasters, but the dignities outflanking the disasters and a positive destiny is kind of aligned with the Cornucopian view, and the Malthusian view is aligned with the sense that, you know, we've forgotten our roots as creatures of a living planet in relation to all the other living creatures, and until we can extract ourselves from this self-accelerating machine of consumption and economic growth, we're going to be the parasites that devour the host and destroy our own well-being. Both narratives point to such important aspects of reality. And for me, I discover that anytime I'm becoming exclusively sympathetic to either one of them, I'm forgetting some important truth that the other holds. And that for me, this swinging back and forth like a pendulum between an even deeper truth on either side of this long-standing debate draws me into a much more fiercely positive and yet deeply heartbroken relationship to the totality of our experience, which is, and the totality of our trajectory.
I'm heartbroken that 9-year-olds act like children. You know what I mean?
Well,
I don't know that that's
heartbroken. I hope you're heartbroken that we have built in so much sea level rise that millions of people are likely to be suffering, you know, in the horrible ways that folks in Puerto Rico are right now and beyond. The care for the destruction, not just of people, but of all kinds of creatures, is a part of my calculus. The more I grow, you know, as Ken says, you know, hurts more, bothers me less. I'm more joyful, but I'm also more profoundly empathetic and in touch with the two-sidedness of life.
Well, yeah, and of course I'm heartbroken by all of that. I think the distinction, because maybe heartbroken isn't it, because that itself is a practice, to feel the, you know, suffering of the world. But the condemnation is the part that, the condemnation of humanity, that is just sort of the subtext of certainly the green response to this, and of course all first tier responses. But green has a special flavor of it that I'm rejecting.
Well, I think we have to rise above this sort of naive, misanthropic, human beings are a mistake. We really blew it when we started having agriculture, you know, the sort of utter rejection of civilization. I am civilization in action. To hate that is to hate myself and to be a performative contradiction. It's silly. We can't go back to that so-called, you know, Eden. It, you know, we went up from Eden.
No, we
and
bring
we're
that
here.
Forward. I mean, yeah,
exactly.
We bring that forward
but,
into
but,
a new
but,
world.
But there's wisdom in the archaic revival. There are all kinds of values, you know, in among indigenous wisdom holders and so forth. I'm ready to learn from everyone, and I feel that the ecologists hold some important truths too. I'm way beyond the naive rejection of any perspective. To me, the awakening to the totality really awakens me into action. You know, there's an awakening that takes place that's not just about higher states and structures of consciousness. It's about, oh, my God, this is really happening in my world, and if anyone's going to make a difference, I'm part of that. And the way that that mobilizes my care is a different kind of awakening. They used to talk about consciousness raising as a political matter, and I think that we're going to see a wave of that kind of consciousness raising interacting with our higher levels and structures and states of consciousness that we've studied as much as we have, and I'm excited about what that's going to bring forward, and I think that you have a huge contribution to that, and your fundamental faith in evolution is a big contribution to that conversation, but I hope
Go
you
evolution.
Will...
evolution!
Yeah, I think, I hope that you'll be... interested
but you
to
guys
include
have, but Terry,
it all.
Terry, can I ask,
yeah.
Can I ask a question? Because mm-hmm. I guess for me, I'm wondering, just listening, when, I mean, Jeff's really clear when he says the place where he departs from the discourse is around condemning human beings that they're bad and wrong and, you know, and not seeing that it's just part of what we seem to have to go through to evolve. And that's what I was suggesting when I said the consciousness and the catastrophe are sort of one. But I guess I'm curious, Jeff, do you hear in Terry's descriptions or in mine, do you hear a condemnation of humanity? Because I hear the back and forth, but I'm not sure we're on the same page about that. Like, Terry, do you feel, you're saying that things are at a tipping point and there are, you know, like, you know, earth-changing stresses in the system, but are you blaming humanity? I mean, is there a condemnation of humanity in what you're saying? I just want to get clear on this point.
No, there isn't. But it's a much more nuanced view of things in which the self-destructive patterns that much of humanity is locked into are appreciated, and the reasons why people come to this misanthropic view are appreciated. There is a partial truth in every perspective, and
that's a bit of a yes.
There's a denialism
okay. That
can hide in faith in evolution. We do have to take very seriously our actual situation and our responsibility to participate in it. So, to me, you know, each time I go deeply into, you know, I resonate with all of the cornucopian evolutionary, we could call it idealism or utopianism, but I'm down. That's what I've devoted my life to. But at the same time, I feel like I can learn a ton from the deep ecologists, from Joanna Macy, from the people who have gone deep into an appreciation and a grieving of all the ways that we've created a world out of balance that's destroying so much of what supports our life. And that reality is part of a grounded positivity, I think. I think to simply always only emphasize the positive is to bypass something important. So I do think that the Malthusians have enormous contributions to the conversation, and I don't want to just, you know, create a straw man and oppose it and just stay in what I already know. I want the conversation to proceed. I want us to listen and discern truths that are outside what we've already seen and grow in our capacity to hold all of reality. And a big part of reality right now, let's face it, folks, is that we're in a large-scale ecological crisis that, you know, global warming is the piece of it we understand best and that's most inexorable to our eyes. But there are other ecological issues that are almost equally problematic. You know, we can't change the carbon count and cure the whole thing.
But if you were going to take Jeff's protest and you were going to integrate the partial truth in it, I mean, how would you integrate what he's saying into what you're saying? You know, this thing about this green condemnation, like what's the integral gesture towards including that truth, I guess?
I kind of feel like I come from a pretty similar place to Jeff. So, you know, in the fundamental positivity and the clarity with which I see that this is a holistic crisis, a crisis of consciousness and culture, as much as it is a right-hand quadrant crisis of ecology and so forth, and economy. And so the fundamental sense that we can create miracles, and that the whole story of evolution has been a story of miracle after miracle after miracle, and the fundamental refusal to simply look at this as a mechanical process that's, you know, doomed and dark and bad, I'm right there with Jeff. So I don't even feel like I have to stretch to include him. Where I depart is if he just wants to reject the sobering perspectives that come from an examination of just how serious our situation is ecologically.
Terry, you know how I love being sober. You know how I love being sober.
Yeah, exactly. But that's a different matter. We have to be careful, guys. That's a different matter. To recognize how sobering it is not necessarily to condemn humanity.
Totally.
I mean, we have
absolutely.
To.
Absolutely. It's a distinction we can make here.
Yeah, that's an important distinction.
Totally. Totally. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Wow, that was vigorous and alive.
Good fun.
Yeah. Well, we can stay in this, guys, but maybe we should invite our community.
Let's hear from the
If people have something they want to nuance or appreciate, please press 1 on your keypad. And we've learned that everybody is happier if we ask you to hold to a relatively brief statement, so if you can kind of hold yourself to not more than a minute and a half or 2 minutes, we'll be grateful. I see that, let's see, couple of hands have gone up. Claire, welcome.
Hi, Terry. Hi, everybody. This has been amazing. I'm very concerned with all of those issues that you brought up. And I just wanted to mention that a book I had written in 2004 that came out of print, I had it reprinted. And it's called The Call of Mother Earth, How a Being of Light Draws Forth Humanity's Response. And I just wanted to mention it because I had it reprinted because it's so, the situation feels so dire, and the solution in the book is basically how this being of light comes down and shares with villagers how they can heal Mother Earth by just expressing from their hearts how much they appreciate her and are so sorry they've neglected her, and name many things that they are appreciating about her until she gets strong enough to give her message, and her message is to live very consciously on the earth and to kind of live an indigenous lifestyle, you know, with caring for the earth and asking the seeds where they want to be planted and, you know, various things, and meditating and collectives. And so I just wanted to mention it. It's something that I'm trying to get publicized by hiring a publicist, because I don't know what else to do in this world, you know, to bring forth my own creative gifts and kind of, you know, bring this out. So it's actually a printer that's doing this, and they have a publicist. It's Bookwhirl, WHIRL.com. And they only
charge.
And the title again?
The Call of Mother Earth, and the subtitle is How a Being of Light Draws Forth Humanity's Response. And it's
by
it's
Claire Rosenfield.
Right, and I've met you, Terry, so in the city, New York City, yeah.
Wonderful,
so,
thank you, Claire.
Very good.
Yeah,
yeah.
Thank you for this wonderful, wonderful conversation. I'm so glad I tuned in.
Wonderful.
Super.
Okay, we have a hand up from Brian. Hi, Brian. You might be muted.
Hello.
We're not hearing you.
Yeah, no, I'm
hello.
Here.
Hello. Good.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello, hello. I just wanted to say that I think, you know, maybe part of the integral gesture is this idea that as we develop, we still have within us all the earlier structures. And it's really like a possibility for caring for ourselves is caring for all the other levels that people are at.
Mm-hmm.
Just really embracing humanity as a developmental matter that isn't supposed to go any particular way. But if I disown some part of humanity, I'm sort of disowning a part of myself. And then you know, there are the basic metaphor for that for me would be raising a child. And there are moments to grab the child by the scruff of the neck and drag him off the freeway or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a way of thinking about it.
Yeah, that kind of relates to the metaphors that Jeff was introducing. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Brian. Well said.
Yeah. I mean, this care for the whole spiral has been a theme in spiral dynamics and in integral political thought. But there are real problems communicating across worldviews when values are divergent. You know, that's how we've gotten into this polarized identity politics, as Ken pointed out in Trump in the post-truth world. Trump got elected in a way simply by targeting the foolish aspects of excessive postmodernism and the legitimate ones, and just anathematizing anything liberal. You know, that this hatred of the liberals on the right is we can not put those people out of our heart, but they're not taking our country in a workable direction. So it's paradoxical. We can care and care for and include everyone, but we sometimes have to take a stand opposed to positions that are clearly unhealthy, and not be afraid to be in a contest. It's not a failure to try to have greater sanity and wisdom govern our public affairs.
Yeah, and I mean, I would offer as part of that conversation that, you know, if I congratulate myself as being integral, but I'm not able to communicate with other human beings the urgency of the moment, you know, maybe I'm not so integral.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And sort of then the problem is our addiction to being right, looking good, being comfortable.
Yep.
And it's sort of up with us. If we want to bring this into being, well, we haven't yet.
You know, one of the things that
me and us.
In terms of an actual practice, I try to make it my practice as much as possible to, when I'm with people who I disagree with, to make it my project to learn from them. You know, it's that St. Francis prayer, is it? That seek not to understand, to be understood, but to understand.
To be understood, but to understand, yeah.
Yeah, and that is, you know, I just went back to my hometown and talked to a lot of my Trump-loving relatives, and to really, what a delicious thing it is to actually hear what piece of the truth they have. You know, and where they're really coming from and where their heart and gut is. And not worry about them learning from me. The act of them actually being heard is, I just trust that evolution will do something with that. You know.
I'll tell you what, Jeff, I think that among our most heroic projects is going to be an ability to have really significant, meaningful conversations that are filled with love with our Trump-loving relatives, such that we
totally
feel our familial connection and our common commitment to a healthy America. That's you accomplish that, and you're a heck of an activist. That's the work that's been hardest for so many people.
Exactly. That's the and I think that's, you know, one way of looking at the integral project, or at least one important aspect of it.
Yeah. Right on. Beautiful. You do that work, Di. I'm curious where your hope lies for, you know, taking your own family as a microcosm of this red state, blue state divide. Where are you seeing the opportunities?
Well, I mean, there are different opportunities. I mean, I think what I hear Jeff saying in terms of really listening and communicating and treating the other person as a genuine human being who has a right to an existence and a right to a perspective is important. And the way our political system works at this point, you know, I would say at the same time developing a strategy to get Trump out of office. So for me, it's really both, you know. It's like the whole point is that we have to hold complexity in that That
Help
complexity
me
means, yeah, like absolutely the treatment of others is, you know, certainly as legitimate on the planet as I am. And at the same time, I'm also willing to privilege a perspective that I think that his leadership is really damaging to our nation, to our standing in the world, and to us being able to implement some of the strategies that we actually know can be helpful to some of these problems. So that's one of the things Ken has offered to me, is that to take perspectives, to affirm others is one thing, but to also privilege higher perspectives is equally important. So just how do you do it is, you know, what's interesting to me. And I think one of the big downsides is that, you know, there's a lot of energy in polarization. There's a lot of energy in opposition. When people are arguing with each other, there's energy there. You know, and when somebody comes and kind of finds a middle ground or shows the way in which people are actually have overlapping wants and needs, it seems kind of Pollyanna. So until we sort of solve that problem, with the media, with the role of the media, it's going to be kind of tricky, because I do think that the role of the media is to feed on the differences, because the differences have a kind of, you know, raw energy to them that the harmony that people don't find quite as interesting. So to me, that's an issue.
Do you see any specific opportunities? I mean, it is as if those dynamics create intensifying polarization and kind of a race to the bottom. And
mm-hmm.
obviously that's not what we want to see. And as a mm-hmm. skilled, you know, a really skilled facilitator and theorist of facilitation and mediation,
mm-hmm.
I'm really curious as to what possible openings seem worth exploring to you, even if you haven't,
mm-hmm.
you know, perfected them.
Well, I would just say for me personally at this moment, you know, I'll be interested to see, because my brother, I've said this before, but my brother has he's a legalized arms dealer, you know, so he has his own private arsenal. I don't think he's a homicidal maniac. He's not. And he's a very responsible gun owner, but he trades and deals with weapons, and I'm just going to be interested to hear his takeaways on what's happening. I intend to go and hear what he's saying right now. I'm just mm-hmm. curious to hear what he has to say before I say anything. So
yeah.
That's coming up for me.
Yeah, I hear you. Beautiful. Well, let's hear from Doris.
Okay.
Oh, I've opened it up. Hi,
Doris.
You're on the line.
Hi, Terry. Yes, I'm. So a couple of weeks ago, I was on the top of Mount Monadnock, which is the second most climbed mountain in the world, not the highest by any means, next to Mount Fuji in Japan. And it was a gorgeous day, and there were about 150 people, I would say, on top of this mountain. It was expansive. And all of a sudden, I saw someone carrying a large flag, and it unfurled, and it was a Confederate flag, a very large Confederate flag. It was on a flagpole, so he had, and it's not a small thing to climb up Mount Monadnock. It's a bit strenuous. And, you know, so he was carrying that, and I just was stunned, and I knew somehow that I could not be silent. He looked like he was about 15, and a guy next to him kind of got it away from him and rolled it up after it was unfurled for, I don't know, about 90 seconds or so, because he had brought it up there and was walking around with it. And I blurted out, and I was probably at least 30 yards away. It wasn't like I could have a conversation with them, although I guess I could have walked up to them, but it just felt like I just felt the need to say something. And I said, "Why are you carrying a Confederate flag?" I think that in my heart, I was truly curious about it. And the kid that had just taken it from him said, "Because my friends are stupid." And then somebody else said, "Well, it's not illegal." And I said, "I know it's not illegal. It's a symbol of hate." And I felt guilty about that for several days, because saying that seems so judgmental and so counterproductive to actually having a conversation. But there really didn't appear. It felt like the only impetus at that point was to recognize it. And then I didn't know what else was going to happen. Well, nothing else happened, because none of those other 150 people, if they said something, I didn't hear it. And nobody came up to me and spat at me or patted me on the back. Nobody said one word, which was another really shocking thing to me about that. But that has sat with me a lot as I really kind of search my heart to see what was going on for me there. And I felt like the most important thing at that moment was to acknowledge and to speak. And in the way that I did it was by, in a sense, sort of damning, saying it's a symbol of hate. I mean, there were probably a number of other things I could have said, but at that moment, that was what I said, and in actually quite a genuine way. So I've reflected on that, and I know that, I mean, I do speak out, and I do it sometimes judgmentally, and I just, it, all of this feels so imperfect, and I'm actually not even caring all that much about how articulate or effective, but I want to be effective. I mainly just want to be genuine, and I want to be on the spot with what is before me, and to just speak to speak to people. And I felt like at least I was genuine, even though if I had had it to do over again, I probably would have said something different. But
well,
anyway,
it's interesting. It's interesting
like
to consider, you know, Doris, I like that story. But what I would want for you to be doing, you know, in addition to the things that you have already said, which are, you know, all legitimate, is to continue to contemplate this, and not so much like come up with the right words to say, but notice
mm-hmm.
the ways that your response reflected what's best and what's not best in you, and lean into how you might express what's best in you even better, and,
mm-hmm.
and be in an inquiry as to how you can show up in that public sphere in a way that's more and more effective and expressive of what's best in yourself. And that
mm-hmm.
inquiry will go on forever, and I don't think that it defines itself in, you know, say this or always try to be kind or some simple formula. There is no simple formula. I think that actual participation and actual growth and actual engagement and, you know, authenticity is an important value, but so is patience, and so is, you know, you're going to grow in your ability to be effective as long as you practice. And that's
what if you
where,
said to him,
mm-hmm.
what if you said to him, okay, setting aside the Civil War and slavery, what do you love about the South?
The South?
Yeah, what do you
what
love,
do
about,
you
the
love about the South? Oh,
yeah.
Huh.
Setting aside those two things,
yeah.
the secession and slavery. I'm going to set those two aside because I don't want to talk about those. But besides those two, why are you so loyal to the South? What do you love about the South? Because then you're able to give the message and at the same time stay in relationship.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. I mean, I honestly, it would never have occurred to me to say something like that because I am from the South and I think of the Confederate flag as being, I guess, a much bigger symbol than the South.
But sure, sure.
It would never have occurred to me to localize it in that way, but that's a good question. You know what I liked about it? I did not feel any hate or any disgust toward anybody. Well, I actually did feel some disgust at the silence fact that nobody said anything, and there were so many people, and that no one said anything afterwards that I knew about.
Well, can I ask a quick question? So it is in Japan. What? How many Americans were in that crowd, do you think?
Knock in New Hampshire.
No, it was on Mount Monadnock. In
oh, I thought you said it was near. Oh.
No.
I said it was the second most climbed mountain. I'm trying to give a sense of, there were a hell of a lot of people up there.
I got you. And most
it was not in
Japan.
Sorry. No,
it was all American.
Yeah, okay.
Right. And it was all a bunch of white folks. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
All a bunch of white folks.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah, no, I'm actually touched that the fact that everybody felt too uptight to engage each other, like, you know, we're talking about politics or religion. This could get nasty. Let's just avoid each other. That's not what I want to see in our public sphere. So that's a really thoughtful and poignant observation. Thank you, Doris.
Yeah, thanks, Doris.
Well,
thanks.
Yeah. Maybe we have time for a really quick one. If I hope this can be fast, Mary Linda. Welcome. Good to see you here.
Hey, thank you both, all three of you. Hi. I think so. I brought this up with Corey and Jeff, but I really kind of wanted to give this to you, Terry, and get your thought. an article that I have really been contemplating on our core ecological problem is they're saying it's not really climate change and global warming. It's just a symptom. It's an overshoot. It's systemic issue because of the rapid growth of resources that have led to our overpopulation, pollution, and loss of our habitat and our biodiversity. So we've really overexpanded, upsetting and overshooting Earth's capacity for us humans. And then as I was reading this and I'm thinking, and is it possible our consciousness now on the planet is only maybe not even 10% that's expanded enough in greater capacity to address this issue? So your thoughts on that?
Well, yes, I write about that very directly in A New Republic of the Heart. I think it's undeniable that we're in a situation right now of ecological overshoot because we are depleting our renewable resources faster than they can regenerate, and we're depleting all kinds of non-renewable resources, and we're creating a situation where we're drawing down those resources such that the actual carrying capacity of the planet is getting smaller, you know, in terms of what could really be sustained. But that doesn't mean that new technological breakthroughs won't give us a chance to have another cycle of prosperity stimulated by a radical new set of technologies. And if this next time around we're able to bring the wisdom of what we can see from the patterns that we've already suffered, such that we discover a unified theory of sustainability, which really would be a profound stage transition for all of human civilization, we could turn this around. The condition of overshoot is not necessarily irremediable. But I think we have to take that analysis seriously. It's one of the most powerful, and I think if you're really unblinkingly honest with yourself, it's a pretty much incontrovertible analysis on the Malthusian negative side of the spectrum. I mean, that's the kind of thing, Jeff, that I'd love for you to just honestly take in and spend some time with and thought, because I think that each time we really take in the contrary point of view, we end up refining our own instincts and we draw ourselves toward a much more nuanced understanding of everything. So I think what you're bringing forward, Mary Linda, is exactly right. We are in a condition of overshoot, and that's profound. It's an evolutionary crisis. It's not a merely historical crisis. It's foundational.
And I feel that too, and I'm with Guy. We, you know, as long as we've got someone of a Trump consciousness and, you know, people that are not willing to put into the resources, as you say, Terry, to where we can do as much to correct this as we can, but with the people that are right now in office, they're not, you know, they don't even believe it's a problem. So, yeah.
Well, thank you, Mary Linda. Well, you know, we're pretty close here to the end. I want to tell everybody about this Integral Living Room. It is going to totally rock. It is going to be our last chance to get together at the Integral Center. It's your only chance this winter to get together with the wonderful Diane Hamilton. And for us to get down in an intimate way with these vital questions and bring them into life as responsible citizens. But, you know, a big part of a healthy politics is fun. Activism has been a drag, and activism doesn't have to be. And I think that's one of the most important contributions of an integral consciousness to this whole subject. So my anticipation is that we're going to get together and have a wonderful time, as we always do. And And Jeff, you have the details here. We have a code that we put in, shout from the heart. That's our theme. Capital, all caps, shout.
Yes, the word shout will get you $100 off if you're registering now. And that's through October 21st, so that's another couple weeks. And the event itself is November 9th through 12th. And you can find out all the details on integralivingroom.com.